am beginning to recognize the fact that nothing is true. Nothing. It's all down to perception. My immediate family is gone, but that's life. It's the same thing with every family, that someone will be left in the end. And this time in life, I have fantastic memories, but everybody's memory is different. So they're just my memories, you know?
That's Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees. He is 74 years old and the last surviving member of the legendary group he performed in with his brothers. The Bee Gees are the subject of a documentary streaming now on HBO Max. We'll listen back to my interview with the director later in the show. First, though, jazz singer Billie Holiday's song Strange Fruit paints a vivid scene of the lynchings that took place across the South in the early 20th century.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern.
The lyrics compare the hanged bodies of Black Americans to fruit hanging from trees. It is clear and direct, impossible to miss what she's saying. For the FBI at the time, it was too much. They feared that when she sang it, audiences would be moved to act in protest. The movie The United States versus Billie Holiday tells the story of her protest anthem and one narcotics officer's vendetta to stop her from singing it. Singer Andra Day plays Billie Holiday. This is her first acting role, and she's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress. She won a Golden Globe last month for that performance. The film was directed by Lee Daniels, and I spoke with him before the Globes.
Welcome, me. Hello, nice to meet you.
You are welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. Well, a lot of people know Billie Holiday and her songs, her love songs in particular, but her political side is not as well known, as well as her problems with the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. That's what it was called at the time, and his name, Harry Anslinger. How did you come to find out about this story?
I stumbled across the script that Susan Laurie Parks wrote based on a book by Johann Hari, Chasing the Scream. And that book, and I read that book after the script, really delves into the lives of Harry Anslinger, Jimmy Fletcher. Harry Anslinger was in charge of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. Jimmy Fletcher, who was one of the first Black feds, and Billie Holiday, and how all of their lives sort of converged at the same time. And I was blown away by the story. When I think of Billie Holiday, I think of a troubled jazz singer in and out of jail with a drug problem. That's what I thought of Billie. Brilliant, yeah. But also troubled. And I never knew the story existed.
Right. And you paint the picture of Harry Anslinger, the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, as really just making it his life's mission to really ruin Billie Holiday. Was it the song? Was it the fact that she was a heroin addict? Was it both? What was it that animated him?
Prohibition was ending. And so his department was closing. And so he shifted it to drugs, narcotics. But Hoover really had a bug, as did him, Anslinger, against the song Strange Fruit. They did not like this woman singing the song. It was about Black people being lynched, and it was causing a bit of a stir in New York City. Black people knew the song, but white people were just being introduced to the song, and it was drawing attention to the murders of Blacks in the South. And Hoover and Anslinger targeted her. They couldn't get their regular men to penetrate Harlem, white men. So they decided to hire Black men to penetrate Harlem and to get to Billie, and Jimmy Fletcher, in walks Jimmy Fletcher.
And Jimmy Fletcher pretends to be someone he's not and really ingratiates himself with her, and she is attracted to him. even after he sells her out and leads a bust against her, which leads to her imprisonment. Can you talk about their relationship?
Yeah. In the film, I've sort of embellished on that a little bit. What we do know is that they had an affair, that Jimmy was in love with her. I don't think that Billy was in love with him. I think that, and so I don't know at the end whether or not he was there on her deathbed, but they did have an affair. He was there to take her down. And I think that once he understood why she was an addict and that he was being used, he became a double agent, really. I mean, in just trying to protect her, making sure that the feds, he could protect her for so long though, and then they caught on to him, the feds, and so he was relieved of that assignment.
Right, and he realized also that he was being used, like he was being used by Anslinger and others, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have related to that so much because of my dad was a cop in the city of Philadelphia. And I remember, I never saw him cry. And he came home when I was a kid and he was crying because of what he had to do to the MOVE people, Mayor Rizzo, or I guess Police Commissioner Rizzo at the time. Just whatever he did, I don't know what it was, but whatever he did, he was turning on his own people as a cop. And I'll never forget him crying about what he did to those kids.
And that was the organization that when they firebombed that, those houses belonging to MOVE in Philadelphia.
West Philadelphia, yeah. And he was traumatized by that. And I understood Jimmy's perspective.
Huh. And that's really interesting. Had you thought about that before you started making the movie?
No, because I was trying to figure out a way to make Jimmy sympathetic. How do you redeem yourself after coming back after that? Billy really didn't judge anybody. All of the men in her life were really, she had poor judgment in men because she grew up in a brothel and what she knew to be good love was not, her understanding of love was sort of twisted. But Jimmy turned out really to be one of the better things just given the husbands that she had. And that's saying something.
Yeah. I think we have a clip of Andra Day as Billie Holiday expressing that thought. And let's hear that.
Me, I only know a certain kind of love that makes me feel safe. And this, what you and I got here is, I don't understand this. I'm feeling control.
Huh, she says, I don't feel in control. And yet she gave over control to so many abusive men in her life.
It's interesting listening to it and not seeing the picture. Uh-huh. It's so much more powerful just listening to it.
Yeah.
It's powerful. Yeah.
That is radio, my friend.
It's
what
strong.
Radio does
it's strong.
At its best. Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about Andra playing Billy. She, I think, gives a magnificent performance, and this is her first major acting role.
Can you believe that?
No,
she's
frankly.
Stunning. Yeah. So many people had talked to me. My friend Simone and her agent had, and my partner, and so many people had told me that I should see Andra, and I knew her as a singer. But I had a couple of actors that were really good. And I was ready to pull the trigger on one of the two, for sure. And something told me to just take the meeting with her. And I met her in Beverly Hills at a restaurant. And I found her fascinating. I was amazed at the reverence she had for Billie Holiday and the respect she had for her. And she was, during the meeting, she asked me whether or not she could even play her. She said, I don't think I can play her. And I found myself at the end of the meeting talking her into auditioning. That's how much respect she had for her. And I was very intrigued. I sent her to my acting coach, Tasha Smith, and to Tom Jones, a vocal coach of mine. And the two of them sort of beat her up and then put her in the ring with me. And the audition was mesmerizing. I couldn't. It was like, I'd never seen anything like that in my career. And I've been around a bit.
Yeah. Well, she has such big shoes to fill because, I mean, as a singer, right, she's looking up to Billie Holiday. She's also probably thinking of the other actresses who have played Billie Holiday, most notably Diana Ross, also a singer.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see how she would be really overwhelmed by the idea of taking on this role as her first major role.
Both of those, she disappeared. You know, there was a vacancy, a sense of lost in her eyes. And I rarely witnessed that type of transformation in actors. She was spectacular. And and she trusted me too, because when you are oftentimes these actresses that and actors that have worked with directors, they give you their best. And sometimes the directors don't really catch their best in the edit room. So actors are tricky because they're guarded. And so there was a trust that she had for me, and we really jumped off the cliff together, she and I.
Mm-hmm.
Into Billie Holiday land.
Yeah, and that's really jumping off a cliff. So getting back to Strange Fruit, the song, Billie Holiday, she didn't write the song, but she really took it as something under her wing, like a song that she wanted to keep performing as a statement, and even if it meant damage to her career. And I guess I'm wondering why she did that, because she had so many other impediments that she had to overcome, including the drug addiction and being followed by federal agents and all that. Why did she insist on singing this song?
I don't think she had anything to lose, and that's what she thought. When you are born in a brothel and you are raped at 10, and then you're sent away to reform school because you were raped, and you grow up a prostitute, pretty much, and then you anesthetize yourself to deal with that upbringing. She was living in the now. She didn't know whether she was going to live from day to day. And I think that when you really look at her work as a singer, that's why she is so profound, because it's all there in the vocals about being present in that very, very second. All of her songs, none of them are alike. Even the same songs that she's singing, she'll sing the same song 100 different ways. For Strange Fruit, she didn't look at herself as an activist or a civil rights leader. She was just living in the moment. She was living for the truth, and she didn't think that she was going to live the next day. So she was determined to be present. I think that's what I identify most about her, she and I, the idea of just being as honest as you can be in your work. That's one of the reasons why I was so attracted to her story too, the similarities between us.
Do you have a favorite Billie Holiday song?
I do. Autumn in New York is my favorite. I don't know why. Strange Fruit is the ugliest thing I've ever seen before. I didn't understand Strange Fruit. Strange Fruit, when I first heard it, it was with Lady Sings the Blues. And I thought, what is this song? I don't understand this song. I was too young, I was a teenager, to really get the significance of this, the lynching part of it. And when I read Susan Laurie Parks' script, it dawned on me that, okay, this is really, really sick and dark and disturbing, ugly. And then I put on Billy singing it, and I got chills, because it wasn't meant to be a beautiful song. It's a call to arms. It's telling people that Black people are being killed. And the description is graphic.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's still relevant.
Yeah. And I didn't even understand the relevance until George Floyd. We were doing this. We did this before George Floyd was the whole incident of during the summer took place. And I did it to celebrate Billy. I didn't really do it thinking that it was going to be that there would be a noose down at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And that during the marches, I was in my edit room, and during the marches, I got two different videos of girls singing Strange Fruit in the mists of the riots and the marches. And I thought, she was right. Billy was right. Your grandkids will be singing Strange Fruit, she told the governor.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I want to thank you for having me on the show today.
That's director Lee Daniels. Andra Day is nominated for an Oscar for her portrayal of Billie Holiday in this film, The United States versus Billie Holiday. And the film is available to stream on Hulu.
Autumn in New York, the gleaming rooftops at sundown. Autumn in New York, it lifts you up when you're run down.
Coming up, you know the film and the song, 9 to 5. It was inspired by real activists.
I really believe that what I'm doing is very important to the economy and that I should have some respect for what I'm doing, as well as higher pay and all.
How 10 Boston secretaries started a movement, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
Yeah, the opening lines to the Dolly Parton classic, 9 to 5. She wrote the song for and starred in the 1980 film, along with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. The three women played office workers who are constantly degraded by their male coworkers. Like in this scene where Lily Tomlin pushes her boss to explain why a man with less experience got the promotion she wanted.
I lose a promotion because of some idiot prejudice. The boys in the club are threatened, and you're so intimidated by any woman that won't sit at the back of the bus.
Spare me the women's lib crap, okay? Now, I know how you feel, and I understand it.
You understand zilch.
I understand I'm still a boss here.
9 to 5 is more than just an iconic film with an iconic song. It is an actual organization. It was started by 10 women working at Harvard University back in the 1970s. They wanted to gain rights for women in the workplace. And through some fierce activism, they built a movement that spread across the country. They were the inspiration for the movie. And now another movie, a documentary, tells their story. Here to talk about it are the filmmakers Julia Reichert and Stephen Bognar. Their movie is called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. Welcome to Press Play.
Hey, thank you, Madeline.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you.
You can't go wrong with that Dolly Parton song.
Oh, you can't go wrong with anything she does, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So tell us, your last big film was American Factory, and that was also about the labor movement. And so how did you pivot to this part of that story?
You know, the new film, 9 to 5, we actually started several years before American Factory kind of swept into our lives. 9 to 5, of course, is a history film. It's it has interviews with lots of great women who were part of that movement and great archival footage. American Factory is a cinema verite film where you get up every single day and run to the factory and shoot, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to you slowly plan to do interviews, you do research. It's a totally different kind of filmmaking, which I love both, actually. I really love both.
Well, one thing we love about both these movies is they don't have one single protagonist. It's, you know, it's a group story. And we love tracking stories where it's like things happen because people get together, you know, and that's how the world, we think mm-hmm. the world, you know, good things happen in the world when people get together. It's not the one hero on the range changing everything.
Yeah. Well, and also both movies, you know, highlight the power of unions and the, as you say, when people get together, things, they have more power. And in this circumstance, the women were office workers. they didn't have a union, right? So they didn't have an organization to go to help them gain their rights in the workplace. They were pretty much powerless in the 70s.
Well, not only that, they actually, women, you know, I was kind of around then. Women were not actually looked upon as real workers in an office situation. They were looked upon as people who worked for a year or so till, you know, they got married or they had kids or whatever. They weren't real workers who needed benefits, who needed a living wage and so forth. And they certainly didn't have unions, but they, you know, they had grievances. You know, they were sexually harassed on a rampant level. Their pay was ridiculous. They were asked to do, you know, you see in the film, they were asked to like wash their boss's dentures or sew up their pants. Oh, there are so many examples of the really degrading things. So they decided to try to do something about it. And there were just a few of them, but then it got, the whole concept got more and more popular because so many women felt the same way.
Well, let me play a little archival tape from your movie. There's also, there's just a lot of really great archival tape in the film. And here is a piece of tape of a woman describing, you know, why she is fed up.
I really believe that what I'm doing is very important to the economy and that I should have some respect for what I'm doing, as well as higher pay and all. I'm still listed as a low-income person, even though I work every day of the year.
Do you work for a living?
Yes, I do.
Do you feel chained to your typewriter?
In a way, yes.
My favorite letter that ever came into 9 to 5 says, "We are referred to as girls until the day we retire without pension." I just thought, whoa, in those 10 words, she got it all.
So that's Karen Nussbaum, who founded 9 to 5, speaking at the end there. And it's pretty remarkable to think that it wasn't that long ago when women in the workplace were referred to as girls, where they didn't have the same rights as men, and they were treated as kind of like office wives.
Oh, 100%. You know, it was fine for the boss to pat your ass. Certainly you were called my girl. I mean, I was a clerical worker at one point, so I know what that's like. Hmm. But, you know, there's another moment in the film, I don't know if you remember it, where there's a sort of a slowed down where a boss has asked his secretary to sew his pants up, and then he's on TV, and he pulls his secretary toward him laughingly. And we slow it down because her face, this is so felt, made me feel like how that time felt. To be a young office worker, sort of like it doesn't feel right for the boss to be able to put his arm around you and pull you close. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you smile because you're supposed to smile. On the other hand, a frown or a worry crosses your eyes, and you can see it in that very moment. And that, when I saw that bit of archival footage, when we discovered that, I felt like it encapsulated what it felt like when those questions were first being raised. You weren't comfortable, you were comfortable. Who was I supposed to be in that situation? That's what that woman's going through. And I know what that feels like personally.
Yeah. So how did these 10 women decide, you know, we're going to organize and try to gain more rights for women in the workplace, for clerical workers? Like, how did they even know how to organize, and how did they build their organization?
One thing they did is they went to a training school for organizers, which was in Chicago, and they got the sort of basics. But the other thing they did, which I thought was quite brilliant, and they did this all over the country, wherever they started a chapter of 9 to 5, they would put out surveys. They would stand on the street at, you know, 7, 8, 9 in the morning, pass out surveys that would ask people, you know, what are the issues at your job? And that's how they kind of built the movement, is through learning the real issues and then calling a meeting, because they got everybody's, you know, phone number or contact information.
And Madeline, it's worth remembering that, you know, in the 1970s, office workers and secretaries were the largest single part of the American workforce, largest sector. There were like 20 million office workers, because this is before computers, right? And this is before everybody typed their own emails, right? Office workers were a huge workforce. And so they were, you know, seeing a river of people going into workplaces, offices, you know, in cities all over the country.
Yeah, that's how they did it. They went, yeah, chapter by chapter, and they found out really what the women in that workforce in that city, what they needed, what their problems were. And they spoke directly to women on a one-on-one basis. They realized that the constituents they wanted to organize were people who saw themselves as second-class citizens. And they addressed that. They helped women gain strength in themselves and pride in themselves. It wasn't just about bread and butter issues. It went way beyond that.
Right. But speaking of bread and butter, what was their goal? I mean, like a bill of rights, if you will, for white collar women in the workplace that they wanted to achieve? Did they want laws changed?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because they did create a bill of rights. It wasn't like changing laws, but it was like the bill of rights. It was sort of like stating, this is what we deserve, putting it in black and white. It's actually a beautiful scroll. I've seen
the original there's a one. Scene in the movie where yeah. you see them unfurling the Bill of Rights in Boston on a public rally. And it's a lot of common sense, you know, demands. It's not anything outrageous, but it's just like human decency, you know?
And, well, I will add, you asked if they were looking to change laws. I think initially, no, but I do think they changed laws. At that time, you could get fired for being pregnant and there's nothing you could do about it. Okay, now that's a change in the law. That happened. Sexual harassment, which was a daily thing, is now illegal. You can get charged with that. They ended up changing laws, but I think initially it was a matter of respect, pride, certainly an end to sexual harassment, and a sense of we're real workers. We deserve real pay and benefits.
How much did the movie make people aware of these issues? At 9to5, the organization existed before the movie, of course, but the movie was such a hit. And yes, it was a comedy, but how effective was it in conveying the goals of this movement?
The movement had already existed for about 8 or 9 years from its beginning, right? So it already had existed. Jane Fonda happened to be a friend of Karen Nussbaum. And so Jane, of course, very entrepreneurial person, thought, I should make a movie out of the stories that I've been hearing from my friend Karen coming out of actually Cleveland, Ohio. So the movie was a smash hit. It was the second highest grossing film of that year after, what was it?
After The Empire Strikes Back.
Right, it got beat out by The Empire Strikes Back. Okay.
Yeah.
It was the second highest grossing film. And how often is a comedy like that, a satire, really? And that's when they really decided, the 9to5ers, in a big way, that, you know, we should go for a union, a national union of clerical workers, a woman-led union. That was right after the movie came out, that they sort of felt like, we can go for this. Not that they hadn't experimented with it, but they went for it nationally.
But what they didn't realize was just around the corner was the entire Reagan revolution and the rise of the right and the rise of union busting organizations. So it's a momentous decision, but the timing proved to be very challenging.
And the busting of the air traffic controllers union by the president. So the president in that case stepped in as an anti-union force and sort of opened the doors for anti-union forces to really be unleashed in a big way and legitimized in the U.S.
And so you mentioned the Reagan Revolution, if you will, and the rise of union busting. But also there was a profound shift in how we work, right? I mean, we don't have fleets of women at their typewriters anymore.
No.
And so was that also a problem in terms of getting organized, that just the labor pool for this particular group of workers shrank?
Well, yes, the ranks of the low-wage workers shifted greatly, sure. The computers came in and, you know, bosses started typing their own letters, and they therefore started getting their own copy, I guess. Today, though, if you look at who are the low-wage workers of now, right, of the day we're right now, it's mostly women, It's mostly women of color. It's a large number of immigrant women who are particularly vulnerable to, you know, being fired, being exploited, and so forth. So the labor movement has to really shift and organize the unorganized again with new leadership. I mean, I'm really hoping we get more, we are getting, and more women leadership, women who come from immigrant backgrounds. That's what needs to happen in their organizing.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show again. It was nice talking to you.
Well, we're thrilled to be back. Madeline, thank you for, you know, your interest in the movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a really different movie, but it does come out of a tradition of ours. And we're super proud of it and think it'll be useful for many, many years to come. That's what we hope.
That's Julia Reichert and Stephen Bogner. I spoke with them a couple of months ago about their film 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. It's available on the PBS Video app. 9 to 5, for service and devotion. Coming up, how the Bee Gees rocketed to fame.
And all five of those songs got into the top 10, and the album became the biggest selling album in the history of music at that time.
They turned the underground gay and black disco movement mainstream and then paid the price. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The most interesting thing about the Bee Gees is not their astronomical fame or the 200 million records they sold. More compelling were the Bee Gees, the Brothers Gibb, themselves, Barry, Robin, and Morris, and their relationship. Robin and Morris were twins, Barry 3 years older, but they often said it felt like they were triplets.
And we always had the same goals growing up, that it became impossible to see each other as normal brothers.
The three set out to become stars when they were little kids, and they accomplished that. First as pop idols in the late 60s. I just gotta get a message to you. Hold on. Hold on. And then, of course, as megastars in the 1970s. Along with the fame and the riches, there was, of course, the dark side. Drugs, jealousy, infighting, and also the death of their younger brother, Andy Gibb. He was just 30 when he died from a drug-related heart attack. Morris and Robin have died since then, leaving just Barry now. He is 74 years old.
My immediate family is gone, but that's life. It's the same thing with every family, that someone will be left in the end.
Barry Gibb is the centerpiece of a new documentary about his family called The Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? It's out now on HBO Max. And the director, Frank Marshall, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be speaking to you, Madeline.
Well, it's nice to have you on the show and to talk about the Bee Gees. I mean, gosh, where do you begin? But let's begin with what we just heard. It's quite poignant to think that after all of that, Barry is the last Bee Gee. When you began thinking about making this documentary, did you think, ooh, this might be a sad film because of all the loss?
I kind of approached it from a different way. I approached it from the viewpoint of a family. I'm the oldest brother in a musical family as well. And actually, Barry and I are 12 days apart in age. And I did know there was tragedy in the family, but there was always this joy and this love that was brought from the music. So it was really trying to explore where that all came from, the brotherhood and the family and all that creativity. So yes, there was tragedy and sad parts, but there was also joy and love and a lot of happiness.
Well, let's begin at the beginning. Three young brothers, they grew up in Australia, fans of the Beatles, and just hell-bent on becoming famous. Did they always think that they would be big musical stars?
Well, that was their dream. And, you know, they they had this very positive attitude. They always thought, well, we're going to do this. And with the support of their parents, I have to say mom and dad were very, very involved in trying to make this childhood dream come true. So dad kind of operated as their manager there in Brisbane and put together their first sort of demos there. And then they came back to England to, as they say, sort of become part of the British invasion that was happening around the Beatles and other groups at that time. Amazingly enough, dad got this letter to Brian Epstein at NEMS, and Brian handed it to Robert Stigwood, and the rest was history.
Hmm. So Robert Stigwood really took them under his wing. How influential was he in creating them and turning them into big stars?
Well, I think he was crucial. The other crucial thing was that dad let Robert Stigwood take the reins then. He wasn't an overbearing, you know, father manager type. And he let Robert Stigwood then take the Bee Gees and develop them into this amazing musical group that they became. And he really became their sort of like their father figure. He also had Eric Clapton in his stable and then created, you know, went off on his own to create RSO Records and took the two of them with him. And they both, he obviously had really good taste.
Right. And also he produced Saturday Night Fever, which we'll get to in a moment. And I think that is what everyone associates the Bee Gees with, is that soundtrack. But they, as I said in the intro, became famous before then. What was their breakout hit?
Well, they had a couple. They had Massachusetts was really their first big breakout hit. And I Got to Get a Message to You, which we just heard. So they had a string of hits in England, and then they finally broke through to America. The other thing that I thought was really special about them is they listened to each other. There was some jealousy here and there, and both Robin and Barry wanted to sing solo, but when they were writing, they became one. And I think Morris talks about that in the movie. So when one of them had an idea, the other two would come in and run with it. So it was just kind of a remarkable relationship that the three brothers had.
Hmm. But as you hint at, there was some competition between Barry and Robin, and the two fell out and didn't speak to each other for many years. What caused that?
Yeah, that's kind of like life as well. As I said, I have two younger brothers, and you know, when you grow up together at home, it's one thing, but then when you turn 20 and there are a lot of other attractions and ways you want to go and you want to sort of spread your wings, there becomes a competition. And I think that's exactly what happened to them. But Robin was the first to leave to go out on his own. And I think there was some encouragement from outside forces there. And he wanted to see what he could do by himself. But in the end, they discovered that they were much better together.
Yeah, I mean, it is a typical tale, right? When young people achieve fame and fortune so early, it becomes too much to handle. And, you know, the inevitable fights, you know, all the drugs and all that happened too. Was that a big problem for them? You know, the excesses of 60s, 70s rock and roll?
Yeah, I think it was for all those groups back in that era. You know, the fame happened so fast, and that they were kind of on the front wave of global pop stardom. That hadn't really happened to people before, and they were so young. They had a lot of money, they had everybody throwing things at them, and so, you know, inevitably the drugs and the alcohol started to take its toll, and they kind of woke up one day and said, this has got to stop if we're going to stay together.
So they decide, we have to go to the States if we want to make it. And they end up moving to Miami. How did they write this new chapter?
Well, it's sort of coming out of the recovery of this sort of excess period. They had a couple of really bad albums that didn't sell any, and they were trying to figure out how to reinvent themselves. And they ran into Eric Clapton on tour, and he said, well, why don't you go to America? You know, I had a great experience there in Miami Beach at Criterion Studio. And sure enough, they took his advice. They were very good at listening to people, I have to say. And they found this new sound. And it was really kind of another rebirth for them.
Hmm. So this new sound that they created, this revolved around Barry and his falsetto, right? He developed this falsetto?
Yes. It came out of that first album that they did there in Miami called Main Course. And they were doing the track Nights on Broadway. And Arif Martin, who was their producer at that time, asked if somebody could do something to sort of take the track out, to end the track. And Barry went in and took a swing at it. And he came up with singing in this falsetto. He didn't even know he could do it. And Arif said, do that again. And then it became the sound of the Bee Gees, and they went from there with it.
Well, then comes, I don't even know how to describe it, the big whale of Saturday Night Fever. Is this the biggest selling album of all time?
It was. At that time, it was. It was kind of extraordinary because they had already become famous, and they were big hits, and their albums were big hits. And they were asked to go to France, I believe, by Stigwood, because it was a tax break if they recorded out of Florida or something. But whatever it was, they chose to go to the chateau outside of Paris that Elton John had recorded his Honky Chateau album at. And so they were preparing an album, and they were doing demos of tracks. And they got this call from Stigwood, who said, you know, I've bought this article and I'm going to do a movie, and said, we need a few songs from you. A couple of weeks later, he got this cassette with five songs on them, and that became the soundtrack. And all five of those songs got into the top 10, and the album became the biggest selling album in the history of music at that time. The extraordinary thing for me, Madeline, was they never read the script. Kind of hurts me to know they never read the script and they just wrote these songs.
Because the movie wouldn't be the movie without the music, obviously. I mean, it's a movie about disco.
Well, I would say it's a movie about dance.
Yeah.
And it became called Disco. But the context that it was in, they thought they were writing dance music. People danced to their music. But then it became labeled disco, I think, after the movie, and created a whole nother hurdle for them to clear.
Right. Well, because disco, as it was known at the time, was something that was underground, right? I mean, it was in the gay black subculture, or at least it was born there. And then it became this mainstream phenomenon, basically because of this album?
I would say yes, because then, you know, it came from the underground to the top of the ground, and it became, these clubs started popping up, and then the Saturday Night Fever album started dominating the radio stations. And, you know, as Charlie Steiner says in the movie, it was like waves in the sea that they would just play Bee Gees music all day, and people got tired of it. And there, you know, there was a backlash to not only the music, but to the commercialization of disco, because it became not good music anymore. And there was this huge backlash against disco, and the Bee Gees very unfairly got caught up in it.
Yeah. So there was that famous scene in the White Sox baseball stadium of Disco Demolition Night, where like 50,000 people were there to destroy disco records. Was that really kind of the abrupt end to the Bee Gees being played on the radio when that happened?
Well, it wasn't just that evening. It was starting to come to a head that summer. And the Comiskey Park thing was kind of put a period on it. But again, they were labeled disco, and radio stations wouldn't play their music. Back then, radio was huge. It was the only thing. It was really a backlash that they had no idea was coming.
Yeah. So what was that like for them? Here they were playing to stadiums one day, and almost overnight, they're pariahs.
They were very upset. They were hurt. They were confused. They didn't feel that their music was disco. They felt their music was all different styles, but they got labeled with that thing that really took them down.
Yeah, so that's in, what, 1979?
Yeah.
After that, I guess they lay low for a while, and they were writing songs for other people? People like Dolly Parton, Celine Dion, Dionne Warwick.
Yeah, actually, what happened was that Barry got a call from Barbara Streisand, and she asked him if he would write a song for her. She was going to do a new album, and he was very flattered and said, of course. And he called his brothers, and they came together, and the three of them wrote the songs for Guilty, which, you know, turned things around for them. And, you know, they were obviously songwriters their whole career, but now they became just songwriters, and they wrote so many tunes for other people that became number one hits. It was kind of amazing.
But, you know, here they were on stage, and that had been their dream since they were kids, right, to be stars. And now, I mean, I don't want to say relegated to songwriting, but writing songs for other people, that must have been quite a come down for them.
Yeah, I think they got a different kind of enjoyment. It's about seeing another artist having a hit with something that they wrote. And it kind of led to them eventually then getting back together there in the 90s. And for me, they were at their height. Well, there's a concert called One Night Only that they did in Vegas, which is 3 hours of their music. I think they did 30 songs. And it's just amazing to watch them. They're at the height of their powers.
Right. But then Morris died in 2003.
Yeah, it was a freak thing. And you know, Barry and Robin were obviously incredibly upset. And then to lose Robin in 2012, it was just, you know, another tragedy. And Barry, you know, just kind of withdrew for all these years. And finally, you know, I think he's starting to come back. He's now written this new album that just came out called Greenfields. You know, he's still very sad. He misses his brothers greatly, but he's starting to come back. And we really wanted to celebrate their legacy and their artistry and their resilience.
That was Frank Marshall. I spoke with him earlier this year about his documentary, The Bee Gees, How You Can Mend a Broken Heart. It's streaming now on HBO Max. Well, I hope you are staying alive and a lot more. That does it for this special edition of Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor, Amy Ta, our digital producer. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.